All right, this is February the 8th, 1998. We're in Austin, Texas, interviewing Amalia Rodriguez Mendoza with a hyphen. And you know the areas we're going to cover.
Right.
So tell us a little biography.
Okay.
And how you came to Austin and what the district clerk does. And,
okay.
And I know that you're pressed for time now, so
that's okay.
Do it as quickly as you'd like.
Okay, I was born in Del Rio, Texas. That's a border town here in Texas, in 1946. I'm a twin. My twin sister's name is Amelia. I'm Amalia. I have two older brothers, Alfredo and Ricardo, and three younger sisters, Rosa and Cecilia and Rebecca. Two of them live here. The last two live here in Austin, and my sister Rosa Maria lives in Alabama. And Amelia still lives in Del Rio. She's the only one back home. And my two brothers live in Fort Worth. My parents' names are Jesus Martinez Rodriguez, and my mother's name was Guadalupe Soto Rodriguez. And his parents were Epitacio Rodriguez, and his mother was Josefa Martinez Rodriguez. My mother's family is my grandmother's name was Vicenta Jimenez, and my Jimenez Soto, and then my grandfather was Jose Soto. And my mother had a sister and three brothers, and my father had nine sisters and brothers, and then my grandfather remarried, and his new wife had three children. And together they had five children. So it was a large family. And my step-grandmother's name, she's still alive. She's in her 90s. And her name is Doña Ermila Rodriguez, lives in Carrizo Springs. I left Del Rio in 1968, and I've been in Austin for 30 years. And I've seen a lot of changes here in Austin. And I was still telling Jose Angel that I remember I always wanted to come to the University of Texas, and that's probably where we'll start. I graduated from San Felipe in 1964. I stayed home for 3.5 years because I didn't have money to come to school, although I was working and I was taking night classes there at the base. And I always knew I wanted to come to the University of Texas because two of my favorite teachers were alumni or UTX's. My counselor, who was Mrs. Keller, and my science teacher, who was Mr. Valdez, who still, I don't know if he's still teaching or not, but he's still in Dublin. So I had a girlfriend that graduated a year after I did, and she was already at UT, and she was a senior at UT, and she kept calling me and saying, you have to come over here, and I really wanted to. I finally got the nerve, and I was at the time going with this guy who's not getting anywhere, and you know, I kind of felt like this would be a good time for me to leave. And I had saved $89, and I moved to Austin in January 31st, 1968.
What did your parents think of that?
It was a surprise to them. And I lived with my girlfriend Blanca Hernandez, who's from Del Rio. And she was a psychology major, and she already had we had come to Austin, and we had rented an apartment and all that. And I didn't have a job. I thought I was going to come to the university and go to school the next day, not realizing that I could just sign up and go, right? I had to take my SAT. Anyway, so they had night courses at UT at the time, which, you know, they had them for only for a little while. There's no junior college here, so I took classes at night and for a year, and then I started looking for a job because I needed to support myself. And I remember applying, and 2 weeks later getting hired with the state. And at the time also I had two job offers. As a matter of fact, I was at TC and I had two job offers. One of them was with Austin Cable, or at the time I don't even Capital Cable, or I don't know what it's called, and the person was from Del Rio, the guy that owned it, Jack Crosby. And I remember them calling me. I think I talked to him, and I said, well, look, I have this other offer with the state. What do you think? Should I take that or should I, you know, I wasn't sure. He said, well, if I was looking for security, I'd give the state, because it was a brand new sort of whole idea on people buying cable, I guess, and it was just starting. And I went and worked for the state for 11 months, and it was with the Department of, it was Social Security Division, but it was the Texas Rehabilitation Commission. Texas Education Agency that eventually became this program that I worked for eventually got taken over by TRC, which is now under TRC. At the time, it was under the Texas Education. And it was it was called the Disability Termination Division. And I was at the Stokes Building, which is right across from the courthouse where I am now. And I was like on the third floor, and I was one of 20, I guess, secretaries or clerical staff in a pool of, you know, a whole room of people with desks and typewriters. And it was on the third floor, and on the fifth floor was the OEO, which was the Office of Equal Opportunity at
economic
the time.
Opportunity.
Economic Opportunity at the time, and one of the persons that worked up there was Gonzalo Barrientos, and they on the third floor they used to have a little coffee shop. So everybody would go by, and he'd go by and he'd wave, and I'd wave back because I was the only Latino that I saw. And then sometimes I guess some of the other Vista people used to come, and there'd be a whole bunch of Mexicanos that come have coffee there. And so one time I was in the coffee shop, and Gonzalo came over and he said, "How would you like to work for us?" And I thought, "Sure, why not?" He was just telling the story the other night about that. So he made. So I said, "Okay." Well, I was going to school. I mean, I was working and going to school at night, and you know, just loving what I was doing. I really enjoyed it. And so then I had been here almost a year, and I applied to this program, and I thought I was going to go work for Gonzalo, and apparently they had funded this new program called the Vista Minority Mobilization Project. And they interviewed me, and it was Jose Urias and Merle Smith. They interviewed me, they hired me to work for them, and their office was on 6th Street, which now, of course, is the famous 6th Street in Austin. But at the time, it was pretty run down, and we had this office that was real sort of long and narrow with no air conditioner. And so I worked there with them, and then we eventually moved. But that's sort of my first meeting with Gonzalo and getting involved in both the whole political arena. I worked for them for a long time, I guess. And then in I must have worked there a year and a half. And then I was ready to go to school full time. I mean, I wanted to go to UT full time.
Did you get involved with Mayo and the protests in Del Rio and the march in Del Rio?
Yes.
You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Well, the program that I was working for, I was on the administrative staff, was the same program that got thrown out of Del Rio by the governor. And Aurelio Montemayor, of course, was one of our... We had 6 sites in the state, and one of them was in Del Rio. And so the march and everything was being planned out of that office. I mean, the phone calls, everything was being done, and we were getting reports every day about what was happening in Del Rio the whole time. And so we helped organize that, plan the planning part of it. And so, of course, I went to Del Rio, and, of course, I was from Del Rio, but the local folks didn't think it was such a great idea. So a lot of the people locally we thought it was too radical to do that. It was Palm Sunday, you remember that, you spoke there, 1969. So I was working for them at the time.
Where were the other 5 sites?
El Paso, the Valley, Del Rio, Laredo. That was 5. Yeah, that was 5.
Okay.
So then all that was going on, so it really politicized me in terms of what was going on and as far as Mexicanos was concerned, because that was one of the big things. And we used to do all kinds of activities out of there, and, you know, we used to have meetings with, you know, Mayo meetings and all that going on there at the office. And because Jose had been involved for a long time also, so he was pretty into all that. So then I decided it was time for me to go to school full time. So in the summer of 69, I enrolled as a daytime student at UT. And I was there, graduated in August of 1972. And while I was there, was a lot of activity going on on campus, because of course, not only was a Chicano movement going on all over, but also at UT, but the women's movement was starting also. And that's when we started having, towards the end of, I guess you came and taught what year? 71. Okay. We had an organization called MASO, the Mexican American Student Organization. And then a group of us, which was Rogelio Muñoz and Joaquin and Rodriguez and myself, and wanted to form the Mayo group, and we formed the Mayo group, and then we eventually convinced everybody to change the name from MASO to Mayo. So, and I was probably one of the few females involved in sort of the political scene, or the political arena, but that's the group that used to organize voter registration drives at Santa Julia on the weekends, and that was in 70 because Moya was running at the time. That was a campaign we got involved with. And were successful, and of course we ran. I ran Gonzalo's campaign on campus in 72 when he first ran and lost, and then he ran again in 74 and won. But I wasn't at the university at the time.
When was it that there was that split, and you probably had split loyalties as well, when both Armando Gutierrez and Gonzalo Barrientos ran?
72. It was in 72.
How did you handle that? What was all that about?
Well, see, I had been involved with Raza Unida, right? But going back to what my first meeting with Gonzalo was, and one of the few people that I met that were Latinos in Austin, having just moved from Del Rio, I was on the Raza Unida organizing committee. And then Gonzalo asked me to work on his campaign, and I really felt like I needed to work on his campaign. So I had to split my loyalties. I mean, I had to... I decided he was going to be probably, I really believed in that campaign and I wanted to help him. And so I let La Raza Unida go because I couldn't be in both places. And in fact, I did try to be both places, but I couldn't because I was helping Gonzalo and working on his campaign.
Do you really believe what he says, that La Raza Unida caused his defeat?
It split the votes, yeah. And I think, I don't know that it caused the defeat, but I think it split votes that didn't need to be split. If there hadn't been another Mexicano in the race, he probably would have won. And he only won by 60 votes the second time. So that was a pretty, you know, and this was sort of our first attempt at politics in Austin. So anyway, so I got involved in politics, there, and I also, somebody told me to tell you a story, what I remembered. And I guess to put it all in sort of in perspective, I guess the political lesson of my life, or my life at the time was when the organizations merged and we became UT Mayo, there was a group of people that had asked me to run for president. And I said, okay, well, it was, you know, kind of time. And so we had a meeting, and some of the women got together. I remember meeting at somebody's apartment. I said, well, we need to run a woman for president. Would you run? And I said, sure. And that was like the beginning of the women's movement and all that. And I said, sure. So there was a big split in the organization because Paul Vélez was not running at the time, but Romel Fuentes was running. And myself and Romel just didn't want a woman no matter what. And there was a whole group of them that didn't want a woman, period. And so Paul was sort of the compromise candidate. So it was three of us running. I still, that's so vivid in my mind. It was one of the most exciting meetings, and it's packed at the Catholic Student Center at the time. And I think everybody came because the people that were supporting me, people that were against me, people that were supporting him, and, you know, all that stuff. So we came to the meeting I mean, there was some really strong opinions about why I shouldn't run. I didn't know that. I mean, I was going to do it because I thought that was the thing, you know. There were some people that felt like it was time. And we had not had a Mexicana. So, of course, I got defeated. I came in second, so they elected me vice president. But
who got first?
Paul. He was like
not
the Rumel. Not Rumel. He was just too way out there.
Was Rumel married already to the Anglo wife and
yeah.
Was from Eagle Pass?
Oh yeah.
Interesting contradiction.
Oh, absolutely. And
Paul Velez was already with Marielena Martinez.
Yes, he was with Marielena at the time. But he was Paul. I don't think ever really wanted it. I think they just kind of encouraged him to do it. I don't know if he did or not, because he was kind of laid back. But he was very involved, and so was I, and we were friends and all that. Well, it taught me to count votes, which is very important. It taught me. I remember. It created that kind of controversy that people still remember, but people don't remember that I lost. They think I won. And I won in lots of ways. I won by sort of asserting myself, and I won, but I didn't win the election. But what happened, the reason people remember it, Della Mae Moore and John Moore think I won that election. They'll argue with me that I won, right?
Who are they?
Della Mae and John Moore. Della Mae's on the school board, on the ACC board, and she was at UT at the time. Son Mexicanos in San Antonio. You remember John Moore, he was with a professor at the School of Social Work at Our Lady of the Lake or St. Mary's. A well-known man there in Austin, in San Antonio. That's his dad. And so people, even Ines, the first time I ever met Ines Tobar, she already knew about it because all the universities, you know, the groups had heard about this happening because it was such a volatile situation, a very contentious meeting, and I mean, it was just kind of got totally just like students do right now. And so that taught me a big political lesson. I remember the next day meeting this friend of mine, and she said, you did nothing that you need to be embarrassed about. You keep your head up high. And I did. I mean, I just, and so then when the meetings would come, Paul didn't want to run the meeting, so he'd let me run the meeting. So I was, you know, the president. So that's why everybody thinks I was president. And then we were organizing one of the conferences, the student conferences, and we decided we were going to have a workshop for women. Boy, you would have never, we should have never brought that out. Some of those guys were really upset. They boycotted the conference. And all we wanted to do was just talk among ourselves because we felt that if we didn't, it was a mixed group, that women wouldn't say some. Not, we didn't even have an agenda. We just wanted to get together and see, well, what are women thinking about, or what do we want to do? I mean, we just wanted to be together. Well, some of the guys got really upset about it. And so I remember those times at the time where everything was in turmoil and, you know, there was a lot of disagreements in a way, but I think because we were being assertive or asserting ourselves at the time, and it wasn't sort of something that some guys expected. And then, of course, we had our strong supporters that felt like, yeah, let's do it, and the women. But because there were not a lot of women involved at the time, I think we had like a little core group that always got involved and did things. But it was a wonderful time for me. I was still doing a little bit of work with the Vista Project, working part-time. I was working at the French Department for work study. Of course, I learned that I had in order to go to school, I could get loans, so I applied for loans, so I had work study. And then I was also working at the time, keeping the books for an architectural firm. And I don't remember if you remember Claudio Arenas, okay, his firm. So I had three jobs. I was going to school, and I would do it all over again. It was the most wonderful time that I had. I mean, I would do it exactly the same way that I did it, and just involved in politics at the time as well. So it was a wonderful time.
Not to get you off track, but I just can't help but wonder if coming from the Rio and the insulated environment of San Felipe and going to school there, did you ever have culture shock?
Oh, absolutely. I remember.
Can you tell a couple episodes?
Yeah. I remember crossing from UT to the drag, and I was still wearing my hair like I wore it in Del Rio, right?
Which is?
Just kind of up and pieced up here, and, you know, totally different than what a student would, because I had been working and living in Del Rio, so I sort of dressed like I was still working. And I'm crossing the street, and I see this Adi Krishna across at the co-op just with that hair. and the long skirt and chanting, and I must have stared at him for like 15 minutes with my mouth open. I mean, just like, oh my God, I can't believe that. I've never seen anything like it. It was just like totally different for me. And then I was convinced that everybody from a small town should go to a big university just because the education that you get there. That was one, that episode was so strange. I mean, I couldn't understand this person that was there standing, singing with no shoes on, and you know. And then I remember when my friend that I was my roommate, that became my roommate, would call me and she said, well, look, you know, going to college is real different. It's not like high school. And she kind of sort of prepared me, but I still, unless you see it, you can, like she said, well, people don't wear shirts if they don't want to, you know. Never. What does that mean? They dress differently. It took me a while to understand all that. I mean, once I got into it, of course, I didn't, and everybody was dressing real hippie at the time, and I never really got into that dress. I was, you know, still kind of more conservative in terms of my dress and stuff. But yeah, there were a couple of times that it just kind of threw me for a loop completely. And I guess I felt like I had not gotten the best education where I was. So I never felt smart enough. I never felt. And then the first class that I ever felt like I really participated in, and I felt like part of the university, was one of the Mexican American classes that was offered, and that was the Spanish dialectology class that we had with Rosaura Sanchez, who is now a professor in California. I don't know. And it was a real small class, and we talked about Chicano dialectology. We even came up with a dictionary that we created out of that class. But that was the first class that I remember fully participating and being part of it. And then, of course, I took all the classes that were offered because the Mexican American Studies Center was just starting. And so it was later in my school that I really felt a part of the university. At first, I felt real like I wasn't a part of it. I did belong to the organizations, and I did participate that way, and we did a lot of the demonstrations and marches, but in class itself, I just kind of never felt like I was part. I mean, geography class had 300 students in it, you know, I just never felt like I was.
So when did you graduate, and what did you do next?
Okay, I graduated in 1972, in August of 72. At the time, there was also some friends of mine that were starting the What is Lincoln Center, and I thought about going to, you know, getting my master's degree, and they kept convincing me, because they were meeting at my apartment sometimes to get this thing going, because it was Aurelio and Montemayor and Andre Guerrero and Leonard Mestas, and so that was like they were meeting in my apartment to kind of plan all this out and all this stuff. So right after I left, I graduated, I started working for the Mexican-American Catholic Alliance, which was Lani Reyes at the time was with the diocese, and they had given some money to this group, and I was their project coordinator. So I was doing that, and then somehow Aurelio and Andre convinced me, look, why don't you work on this, on your degree, on your master's degree, and this is, you know, we'll develop the curriculum, we'll do that. And as part of my job, I was organizing youth retreats and we would get students, Mexicano students from high schools on the weekends, and we would do cultural and historical sort of retreats, so that they would talk about, and basically they were writing their little story about who they were, because it was not something they were, their own history, because it was not something they taught in schools. So we would get them from the different schools, and we would go through the churches sometimes. And my connection with the Mexican-American parishes was to get their youth programs involved with that. And when the students came in, of course, everybody was real proud of what school, high school they went to, so that, you know, they were, well, I'm from Austin, I know I'm from Johnston, and so they weren't really together. By the time we left there, it was incredible. It was a 2.5-day retreat, and usually at a church facility. And Aurelio Montemayor was sort of the trainer, and we would bring in speakers from the university. We would bring in, and a lot of those students are still around, and they're, you know, they were high school students at the time, and they're still involved, and they're still doing things. And Rogelio Brun at the time, Roger Brun, was sort of like the person behind doing all of the curriculum and doing, you know, sort of, he was the brains kind of thing, and we would kind of put the events together. Anyway, as part of my master's, that's what one of the things I needed to do was to get funding for this project. So I got funding from IBM to, you know, for the, it wasn't big money, but sort of how to write a proposal and how to present it and what to do. And okay, so we got funding, and I stayed with them 72 through 74. In 74, I got my master's from NTIOC. Well, it was through Juarez Lincoln, but it was accredited by NTIOC College in Yellow Springs, Ohio. And as soon as I got my master's, all along, a friend of mine who was with the CERT project here in Austin was talking about they wanted to write a proposal for a statewide project for CERT that was going to be funded through the governor's office to do for a job bank. And she said, we'd like for you to apply. And I had just gotten my master's, and I was working for the diocese at the time, making like $6,500 part-time. I mean, it was a little job to have while I was going to school. And I applied, and I remember when I went to my interview, I knew everybody on the board, but from different things that I knew. I mean, I knew everybody there. And that evening, and I had been married almost a year, and that evening, I was going...
Who'd you marry?
Val Mendoza from San Antonio, Texas.
Was he also involved in all
this
stuff?
Yes, he was involved, and he was going to graduate school in business at the time. But he was involved in all that.
Why'd you marry him?
Because I thought... I guess he was the one that I was sort of attracted to and I loved and at the time, and just kind of somebody I thought I wanted to spend the rest of my life with.
Okay.
And
how long did that marriage last?
12 years.
One daughter.
And one daughter.
What's her name?
Her name is Melissa Mendoza.
And where is
Guadalupe.
She?
And she's right now living in New York, going to school at Barnard College in Columbia. And this is her second semester of her second year. So she's a sophomore. And her birthday's next, in 2 weeks. She'll be 20.
Okay, and when were you born?
I was born in 1946.
Okay.
So I'm 51, I'll be 52 next week, the 17th. And
so you're working with Project Saturn. What was that like? How long did it last?
Well, I applied and I got hired. As a matter of fact, I found out that night from a friend of mine that I had been hired and it was not supposed to be a no-no. I mean, they weren't supposed to release it till later, but I found out about it. I worked for them for 7.5 years. It was a nonprofit organization. CERT was national CERT. I mean, there was a national CERT program that was funded through the Department of Labor funds to provide employment and training in the Latino community. And this project was a little bit different. It was a statewide project, so we had offices where the different CERT offices were, and one of the things that I've really enjoyed is I guess I consider myself a self-starter. Most of the projects that I've been involved with, I developed them myself. So this was a brand new program, and what we were there to find jobs for minorities and women, and to place them in the public sector, the private sector, educational institutions, and it was a very successful program. And what we did is we would work with state agencies to find out what their openings were. Then we actually had job counselors and job developers that developed the jobs and counseled the applicants and then placed them in jobs.
For women?
No, minorities and women.
Oh.
So we worked mainly with Latinos.
Had some of the attitudes against women being involved kind of quieted by then?
Pretty much. Well, you know, it's the mid-70s. So... Oh, and I was going to say, when I first applied for this job, I was the only woman that applied, and the other ones were males. And I just didn't think I was going to get it. But what happened is immediately after I got my master's, I doubled my salary, not that I was making this big salary, but I thought to me that was the value of education too, that, you know, I had sort of done all this, that eventually it was going to pay off, you know. And sure enough, it did. I mean, I was real proud of it. I thought it was great. And I was doing something totally new, totally, I thought we could be very creative with it. As a matter of fact, Moya always wanted to duplicate that when he was with Ann Richards in state government. He kept saying, we have to fund another job bank. Because
he was on the board? Or
No. This was much later, when he was with Ann, with the governor, with Ann Richards at the time. He always said, we need to fund another program just like it, because it went on for 7.5 years. I mean, I still meet people that say, I got my first job. As a matter of fact, the other day, I remember when you got me that job at Southwestern Bell. I mean, it just... Anyway, so at the time, it was something new that we were doing, and I thought very rewarding in a sense, because when you find somebody a job, it's just something that, you know, kind of gets them on a different track. And we had certain criteria and eligibility we needed to fulfill, but we helped everybody. Somebody walked in the door, and we helped everybody. And we were very... accessible and all that. It was real close to. I mean, I guess my jobs have always been within a 2-mile radius. That was like 2 blocks away from the courthouse, and I had been at the courthouse, I mean, at the Stokes building before. So anyway, I worked for SER, like I said, for 7.5 years. Then there was a change in administration. Clemens came in. He did away with all those jobs and decided, you know, it doesn't matter whether they had married or not, and got rid of the jobs. Our last month there was September of 1981.
How did you feel being fired?
Like it wasn't fair, because they didn't even look at what we were doing, and I thought we were doing a good job of placing minorities in jobs that they probably on their own maybe would not have had the opportunity, because we knew who the people involved in hiring were, and we established, and by the time we left, we were sponsoring job fairs all over the state. We had a separate contract that went into the small communities and brought in employers there, and so it was, now we had expanded, we were no longer local, we were all over the state. So we were able to do some things. The thing about, but I also knew that this was a year-to-year project, so I never had my hopes that we would be there for the rest of our lives either, because it was, I mean, 6 months into the project, you had to be working for funding for the next year. You know, that's nonprofit, that's the way it is, and it was governor's discretionary money, so they could be pulled. I mean, I never kidded myself or fooled myself. I didn't like the way it was done, because I don't think they looked at what the program was doing and how successful it was.
So what happened next?
So then that's when I took some time off to be with my daughter, who was 3.5 at the time. And I've always gotten sort of into the holidays, so it was a good time for me to kind of take a break and then start looking for a job. And at the end of December, this was in September, October, November, and December, I stayed with her. The end of December, I was looking through, and I said, by January I'm going to start looking, and then I'm ready to go, and Melissa can go into daycare at the time. She had stayed home with I had a housekeeper at the time, so she never left the house. I mean, she was home, and I thought she was ready to go into child care at the time. And so I applied for a job that I had seen an advertisement for. I had applied for different jobs, but this job really caught my mind, caught my eye, because it was director of voter registration. And I had been involved, like I said, in politics the whole time. I was involved in voter registration drives all the time. That was something I enjoyed doing. And I thought, what a neat job to have, to get paid for it too. You know, it was something I was going to enjoy. I got hired by the tax assessor, who was Bill Elshar, who is now the county judge here in
Texas. How do you spell the name?
L-E-S-H-I-R-E, Bill Elshar. And I worked there for 7.5 years. I really enjoyed my job. We did some really wonderful things there. We had the highest voter registration rate of any metropolitan county in the state. We continue to have that. But I think we really instituted voter registration, and that was our whole goal, was to institutionalize it. And so that people, every time they thought about voter registration, they, you know, and of course the next step is if you're registered to vote, you can vote. Although we were limited in terms of doing the get out the vote efforts, we did the first step. And by achieving, we had, at one point we had 88% of the people in Travis County registered to vote. 80% is incredible. With 88%, but we worked very hard at it, and it was a lot of fun.
Why do you think you got the job?
I think I was, I talked about my involvement with campaigns and voter registration, but I think that the, I was saying earlier that I think what clinched it is when Elshar, he was real tough on interviews. I mean, he was a tough, so he said, I'm going to start by giving you a list of 25 names, and you tell me who they are and what they do. And I said, okay. First one on the list was David Dean. I didn't know who this guy was. I didn't know at the time that he was the Secretary of State and that he was probably the only official I needed to know. But the next 24 people, I knew exactly who they were, what they did, and I think that impressed him. I think said, if you're going to work in voter registration, you have to know these people, and they were either politically active or they had something to do. So then when he told me that this one was the Secretary of State and that he had been a Republican, a Democrat and was now a Republican, it never left me. I mean, I always remembered that. Lesson number one was know who the Secretary of State was, is. But
were you among the first almost high-level administrators in the county that was Mexican-American
yes,
and female?
Yes, absolutely. Probably the only appointed Latina at the time. And there weren't, I mean, there weren't that many.
How much staff did you have?
I had four people, and then eventually I had six people, including me, so I really added one more staff.
Could you hire or fire them?
Yes, I interviewed them and I hired them. As a matter of fact, I hired a friend of yours that you, she told me to tell you hello, Norma Guajardo. She was a student, and she now works for me and has worked for me for a long time, but I hired her at the time. And we became very good friends, and she was a great worker. And wait, this is an aside. And then she got hired away from me by the director of data processing because she was so good. And then when I took over as district clerk, I brought her back as my secretary. And now she is the manager of my criminal division. So it's, she's got a staff of about 20, 25 people that she...
But I thought voter registration was under the aegis of the tax assessor.
Well, yeah. Well, now I was talking about that happening now. But at the time, when I hired her, she was one of my clerks in voter registration, was under the auspices of the tax assessor collector at the time. And it still is. It's still under the tax assessor collector. In Travis County, we have the division of duties. The county clerk handles all of elections and the tax assessor handles voter registration. And I think what was fun, the fun part of the job, I mean, the job was always fun, is because Elshar made it sort of his little baby, and he, anything I wanted or whatever I thought about, it was great for him, and he was always helping me with making things happen. Like, okay, well, we want to do this. Well, you know, he was real helpful in that way, and he's got a certain management style that can be real rough sometimes with other people, and I always had a very cordial relationship with him. As a matter of fact, I remember going to a Mayo, not a Mayo meeting yet, MAD meeting one night over at the Moya house, and we were having a meeting, and I disagreed with Moya about something, and Moya was a commissioner at the time. And people still remember this. He told me in front of everybody that he was going to have me fired. So I came the next day really scared talking to Elshar. I said, you know, last night I was at this meeting and I don't even know what the argument was about, but I was saying something that he didn't like and he threatened me, you know. I remember Elshar said, nobody can fire you but me, and I'm not going to do that. So, but I think a lot of people noticed that he was sort of being a little more strong arm than he needed to be. But, you know, that kind of, that doesn't have to be publicized, but that was one of my experiences. Anyway, so I worked there for 7.5 years, and then I decided it was time. The opportunity came up that the district clerk who was in office decided to retire. He had worked in that office for 30 years. He was 56 years old. He had enough time to retire. And I thought he was very young at the time, so I thought he was never going to retire. And he surprised all of us. So I had already talked to some key people, telling them that eventually that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to run for office, and that's the office I wanted to run for. And so when the opportunity came up, a lot of people already knew that that's something I wanted to do. And there were some other people that decided they wanted to run too. And this is the first time that office, since I probably it was created, had that kind of
interest
and opposition. I mean, where it was actually people running in that office, because he had been there in the office 30 years, but he had been district clerk for 4 terms, which was 16 years, and he had never been opposed. And the Mr. Martin right after before him had been in office like 40 years, and so I'm like the 8th or 9th district clerk in the history of the office.
Were you the first Mexican-American woman elected?
I was the second Mexican-American woman elected to Travis County. The first one was Dolores Ortega Carter, who is the county treasurer. Countywide. Now, Margaret had been elected precinct-wide. But I was the first minority I've been the first minority in this office. Not the first woman. There was a woman back in the 40s that served 1 year. So I couldn't technically say I was the first woman, but the first minority female.
So who were the opponents? How much money did you raise? How many volunteers did you have? How did you win?
Oh, I think the strategy worked very well. I was the female in the race. There was three men. One was a county employee that was with a constable's office who was considered the quite liberal, who had a lot of contacts and a lot of support out there. But so did I. My base of support was Latinos and Mexicanos. I had helped organize the Mexican-American Business and Professional Women's Organization, MAPWA. So I had a base of support of women. And then I also had helped organize the Hispanic Women's Network of Texas, the first Latina statewide organization. And I'd been involved in politics, so I felt like I had a base. And then there was another Anglo man that was married to Dolores Carter at the time, or was in the process, was not married anymore. They had been husband and wife. She was the county treasurer. And I guess he wanted to hold office because she was holding office. I don't know. And then one of the employees of the district clerk's office, his name was David Alvaro. And I was concerned at the time because David was a Hispanic, and I thought that that would help split the vote in the community where we needed to be strong. And I can attribute my win to the Hispanic community because I led in that community by 500 votes, which is like probably the turnout in certain precincts. And I won by 1,100 votes. I was in a runoff. None of us got a majority the first time, but we were in the runoff. The white liberal was Bruce Elfant, E-L-F-A-N-T, and myself. And in April, which was a month later, I led. Actually, he led in the absentee ballot, and usually that's sort of an indication how the rest of the election is going to go. But I came very, very strong in some areas, and he beat me in some, but overall, I did well all over the county, which surprised a lot of people. They thought that, I had led in the primary, but they thought I could lose it in the primary. In the runoff, I raised $35,000. I spent $35,000. I raised a little over $20,000. I put some of that on myself. I got money from the unions and labor. I got money from the Women's Political Caucus. I got money from individuals, from law firms, from individuals with that knew other people. I mean, it was just amazing how people just that were supporting you would do it. I walked and walked and walked a lot of this county because I knew parts of it. One of the things that I learned in voter registration that has been a good skill is that I was never very familiar or liked maps before I went into voter registration. I learned this county backwards and forwards. I knew every precinct. I knew, I can still remember my voter registration card number by, you know, that just was my whole life for so long that I became very familiar with the county itself. So I walked precincts. I had volunteers walking during the day with me. I quit my job in October. The election was in March. November and December, I did the Hispanic precincts or the Latino precincts here in Travis County, and saying, okay, I mean, I'm just going to let them know that I'm running, but I really need to concentrate everywhere else. People didn't know me. They didn't know who I was. My biggest asset was that I had 15 years of management experience and that office needed a manager. Nobody else could claim that. And I had worked for the county, so I knew about county budgets, and I knew how to do processes within the county. I had lots of volunteers. I had a little office. As a matter of fact, you came there when at Teotitos. It was right behind Teotitos at the time. Diana Jaime was the one that offered the place. We had signs everywhere. I mean, we had it was a pretty interesting campaign.
How did you survive if you quit your job?
I had cashed in my retirement of 8 years with the county, pretty much 8 years with the county.
How much money was that?
It was $16,000. And I left, I guess I loaned my campaign, because eventually I'll get it back, I don't know, $10,000 maybe.
Did you ever get it back?
I got little bits of it back whenever I raise a little bit of money. But
you better hurry up. In this campaign, make sure that's quieted.
And of course, at the time I was supporting my daughter and I, so a lot of that money.
You'd gotten divorced by then?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was divorced in 1986, and this was in 1989-90. And so a lot of that, some of that money I used for. But the reason I did that, and, you know, there are things that you never regret in life, and that's not, you know, and I've never regretted doing that.
We're talking about divorcing or running for office?
Running for office or divorcing. Running for office, no, cashing in my retirement, because I knew that I was going to give it everything it took. I didn't want to be 65 years old and I should have done that, or I should have put that money there and I kept it. I didn't want to have any regrets about it. It was a calculated risk. I cashed in everything I had and I ran. And it was going to happen or it wasn't going to happen. And it happened, and I'm real glad, and I would do it exactly the same way.
Let me ask you something else that I've been wanting to find a break, and this is a good one. You mentioned going to a MAD meeting. When did you stop supporting Raza Unida and join the Mexican Democrats, and why?
In 1972. That's when Gonzalo ran, so it had to probably be 71.
Well, there was no MAD then. MAD didn't get started until 1976.
Oh, no, not MAD.
That's what I'm asking. When did you stop being Raza Unida and join MAD? Do you remember at all? You became a Democrat. You were Raza Unida.
Yeah, but I wasn't. Matt wasn't at the time.
No.
It was in 71 when Gonzalo ran.
Oh, you stopped all Raza Unida activity.
Yeah, because I was supporting him. He was a Democrat. Okay. And I was an officer in the local Raza Unida. I think I was secretary or treasurer. I don't remember. But I couldn't do both. I mean, either my loyalties had to be with one or the other.
Okay.
And I chose going with the Democrats.
Okay.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I was going to bring you up then to
72.
What's the budget of the district clerk? How many staff do you have? What's your salary? What do you do with district clerk?
The district clerk's office is a major office in the county. All of the lawsuits that get filed in district courts get filed in my office, and we process all of the paperwork, all of the documents that get filed in a particular case. We have both civil and criminal. And my office is divided by areas that we have lawsuits filed in, like general litigation that includes something that doesn't fall within, like family law. We have a family law section. We have a government section. So a lot of the cases against that the state files or they're filed against the state get filed in Travis County. So our jurisdiction, we have statewide sort of jurisdiction because the seat of government is here. But we also have, in the criminal section, we have all of the felony cases. We also handle grand jury, juries, We have a major department in accounting because we handle a lot of trust funds. We have probably anywhere from 600 to 800 accounts with probably $18 million worth of trust funds.
So you're responsible for investing those?
Yes, I'm responsible for investing.
Do you have discretion to invest them wherever?
Not really. Unless the court, the order does not specify, we either go with our depository contract or we find, if it says to find the best rates, that's what we do. So that section, I think the one that, the area that I most enjoy in the office is what we've been able to do, some of the new things that we've been able to do, like consolidating the jury system here in Travis County. The other thing was we brought tax filing into the office when I first moved in. We're now in the process of doing when I first ran for office, one of the, I guess you used to call them issues or platforms or whatever, was that that I was going to work real hard in trying to get an integrated system, justice system going. It's taken 8 years, but we're now in that process. When we first started in the office, none of the law enforcement offices could speak to each other through computer. I mean, not everybody had different computers, different systems. So we've worked, my office has been involved in this committee that has worked real hard to try to get a system that will eventually link everybody together, because we do a very vital part of that system, because if somebody gets arrested, all of the paperwork eventually comes to us, depending on what kind of case it is.
Well, and the juries, sure. All the courts.
Oh, yeah. But, yeah, now the juries, we've worked on that already, but we've already automated some of that. But this one will link everyone together, you know, so that when the DA's office is preparing an indictment or they needs to go to the grand jury, some of that paperwork has to filter through my office, and when it comes back, it filters through my office. All that. So, we are, a lot of the employers and people outside the public needs information about criminal records. They have to access information. Sometimes just to serve someone or to know what warrants are out there. I mean, it could be that some office has information that we don't have. We work with adult probation. We work with a lot of offices. And so eventually, now we're in the process of developing the, actually writing the program that they've already funded, it's called the Integrated Justice System, where all of the county offices that deal with law enforcement and accounting and everything else are going to be linked together, which is a major, major project. But that was one of the things that I was going to work on, and I'm glad to say that 8 years later, it's happening.
Budget?
Okay, my budget is $2.5 million. I have 85 employees. My salary is $65,000 a year. It's gone up to 68, I think.
How many judges you service?
There are 13 district judges in Travis County, 9 civil and 4 criminal. There's three masters, one magistrate, and there's some Title 4D, which are child support, that really don't have a lot to do with my office, but they're also part of the system.
Any minorities involved in those groups?
There are no district judges that are Mexican-American. The magistrate who is appointed by the criminal judges is Latino, Coronado, Jim Coronado. None of the masters that are appointed by the judges are Mexican-American. However, the Title 4D cases that are the 4D masters, are both of them are Latinas. Angelita Mendoza Waterhouse and Dulce Madrigal are both masters, but they're appointed by a judge in Seguin. So none of the Travis County, except for the criminal magistrate, are Latinos at that level, at the district judges level.
Any blacks?
Yes, there's a criminal judge who is black, and that's it. There are 4 women judges, district judges, that are all Anglo. there's in the county itself, there's one Latina county court of law judge, one Latino county court of law judge, although he has opposition. And there's one justice of the peace, Elena Diaz, and then one that's running for justice of the peace, Gisela Triana, and then one county commissioner who's Latina. The county treasurer is Latina. I'm Latina. And the constable in precinct 4 is Hispanic, Medrano, Rocky Medrano.
How do you feel about all this different choice of words? Chicano, Mexican American, Latina, Hispanic?
It's confusing sometimes. But we were talking about that yesterday.
What's your preference?
Latina.
When did you change to that?
About 4 years ago, maybe.
Any reasons?
No, it was just kind of encompassed more, I guess. I don't know. I mean, politically, it was just like, you know. We were talking about that. Yesterday, I was at a retreat all day. I'm on the Breast Cancer Resource Center board. And we were having a retreat. And last year, we had a retreat. We had no African-Americans on our board, and we worked real hard. So this year, we had two, right? And they were talking about what's politically correct. They were the ones that brought the conversation. And she says, well, everybody was saying African-American. I said, no, no, no. She goes, no, no. I said, what is it? No. Now we're American, Americans of African descent. She says, but keep, you know, sort of stay with us. You know, it might change, but, you know, so it's the same thing. It's like Latinos, Chicanos, Mexican-American, Hispanic. I mean, they're interchangeable in a way. I mean, it's...
You have an opponent now.
Yes.
And who is it, and what are you doing to make sure you win?
Okay, I'm raising money right now. I don't have any opposition in the primary, so that primaries in Texas, both parties are hold primaries, and I'm unopposed in the primary. He's unopposed in the Republican primary. He's a 22-year-old law student. I'm right now raising money to be able to have... some money in the fall to be able to do signs, television, whatever I need to do. I think that he's not going to have to run a campaign because really it's his name, although I think he's going to be active. I don't think he's going to have to spend a lot of money because a lot of Austin, I mean, in Austin, Austin has grown so much that in the last 8 years, I haven't run a campaign really in 8 years. So a lot of people... Yeah, I have some name ID because people get called for jury duty and they see my name on there. But there's a lot of new people that maybe don't know anybody, the difference between me and him. His name is Stephen Foster. They're going to go to the ballot. They're going to see his name and my name. I think there's some people that are going to vote for him based on his name. Same way that some people are going to vote for me because of my name. So I have to get the word out. I have to mount a campaign. I have to be serious about it. And run on my record and one of the things that I've been able to do in my office. And everybody says, oh, 22, you're not, don't worry about it. I said, no, you can't take anything for granted because there's a lot of people out there who have moved in that are Republican that don't know anything about anybody running. And they're all going to see his name as a Republican, they're going to vote for him. I don't know how strong party loyalty is here, but Travis County has been the strong Democratic stronghold. It might change. I mean, we have a lot of new people.
If you lose, what would you do?
I'll probably stay in public service somehow. Work.
No
work
retirement somewhere. Plans?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No retirement at all in the future.
Some people feel that the grand jury system is stacked in a throwback to ancient times and it's basically all white dominated. Is that the case? And how does it work? And then tell us about the jury process
okay.
in general.
The way the grand jury is picked in Texas is the criminal judges, which we have four of, there's three Anglos and in black. And I guess you could consider Bob Perkins pretty aware of Mexican-American politics here in Travis County. Although he's not Mexican-American, he's been involved for a long time. Select five people that they know in the community that they call grand jury commissioners. Those grand jury commissioners meet and they nominate four people that they know and then that list of 20 goes before the judge and they get called to come and see they're able to serve on the grand jury, which is a 3-month term. And we have 2 grand juries going all the time, so that 2 judges pick grand juries. We've seen some diversity here in Travis County. I think there's very few times that we've had all white grand juries. Now I can't say that for all of Texas, but I know that we have. I think Travis County has been a little bit ahead of the curve in terms of electing Hispanics. I think females have done better in Travis County. I know that when I ran, is when Ann Richards ran for governor. I think that helped because a lot of women went out to vote. But I think overall, Latinas have been pretty lucky in terms of, I mean, we haven't just ridden the coattails, but I think it's been helpful that as more people go out and vote, and the information gets out to them that they will vote for Latinas. So I'm hoping that that's still true.
What do you think that is in terms of the male-female?
I think that in Travis County, more women vote. We have 51% turnout of women, 49% of men. We have one of the highest voter registration rates, like I said. I think there's been some studies that have said that people trust women in public office. And I think that it's just been something that it's a trust factor, I guess.
Tell me about the job you do with juries.
Okay, when I first took office and we were having the different, I guess we could call them jurisdictions or offices that dealt with jurors. It was a fragmented system where if you were being called for jury duty in the district courts, you got called on Mondays. If you were in the county courts, you got called on Tuesdays. If you were on the JP courts, they would pick you from the courthouse and ask you to come and serve in a jury or wherever they were. If you were in municipal court, they'd call you for jury. And I remember when I was in voter registration, running the voter registration office, because jurors were picked from voter registration lists, I would get call after call from people complaining, I just served on a jury, and da 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 da. And so then when we looked at it, and I looked at the system, it was very fragmented. People were complaining all the time. And we looked at what could we do to improve the system. And so what I did is I approached the other offices that were calling jurors, and I said, look, we have this plan. I remember showing it to the judges and to the commissioners and said, we'd like to consolidate, if we can, all of the offices where we call one time. Well, the person gets called one time, whether it's to serve in any of those courts, and the other offices agreed, and some of them, I think that they were relieved to do this, and I said, and I'll be glad to run it, I'll be the one in charge of it, because when we call juries, not only am I involved with, the sheriff's office is the one that's supposed to monitor the summonses, and they're the ones that mail them. We actually select, we reconstitute the jury wheel once a year, and we have a plan that does that. It means that you get a new list of registered voters and a new list of people with a driver's license, and sort of randomly we put them in what we call the jury wheel, which is, that's a sort of an obsolete term, because at that time, a long time ago, they used to do the wheel. Now it's all electronic. And so we reconstitute it once a year, and we just did that in January. And we add the new names, and then we select, all year round, we select from that pool of people. And so we consolidated where all of the offices agreed that I could run it, and they would offer some help, assistance by providing staff. The municipal courts, we had to do an inter-local agreement with the city where they would were willing to give us the rates that the city would get for renting the auditorium or a big coliseum, and then, I mean, they charge you for everything. And so we were getting the city rates for every chair you use, for every table you use. And
we're talking massive numbers here, no?
We're talking about calling 5,000 to 6,000 people a month. And then people should respond either in person or by mail. and we have two sessions. So the sessions could be anywhere from 1,500 to 2,000 people, and that's a big group. We have one of the most user-friendly systems in the state, where we actually allow people to look at their schedules. When is the convenient time? Sometimes people say, "Well, I don't have any convenient time." Well, they have to make a choice. They have to pick a time. We'll work with people's schedules pretty much. People are allowed automatic postponement if they can't serve when they're called. We now have a system in place where prior to us being fully automated in the jury system, if you didn't show up, we didn't know where you were. Now we know everybody that was called, and if they don't show up, now we have a barcode, and every time we get a summons and the people responded, so anybody that doesn't respond, we'll send them a second notice. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing how many people have shown up because of that. Now it's unpredictable how many people will show up because they're responding to the second notice. And then if they don't show up again, then we'll do a third notice. We haven't had to go that far because I guess we've been doing this for...
Nor have you had anybody arrested?
Yes. Some judges will do that. But that's after people have shown up and gotten assigned to a panel. We've never arrested anybody because they didn't show up the first time, although that says on the summons and it says on the second notice that they will be arrested.
Have you ever considered running for any other office?
Yes.
Which ones and why not?
I'm waiting. I mean, I think at some point in my lifetime, Latinos are going to be able to pick and choose what they run for and win. I mean, that's my vision of what I see. And the reason I'm saying that is because of demographics. And if we institute that whole culture of voting, and I think people are always complaining that Latinos don't vote. Well, we have a lot of young people. I mean, the young people, period, don't vote. But I think we're finally getting into where the baby boomers are now becoming the older folks, right, that have a history of voting. And I think eventually we're going to be able to pick and choose. I'd like to run statewide. I don't know for what office yet. I was asked to consider a statewide office this time around because they didn't have any women running. I didn't think I was ready. I just didn't. I need more visibility, I think, statewide. Although I've chaired the Governor's Commission for Women. I was appointed by the governor, and I did a lot of statewide. I have an opportunity now, and that's sort of my plans are to work to get more visible statewide. One of the ways I'm doing that is I'm really involved with the County and District Clerks Association. If God willing and I win this election, I'm the first vice president of the association right now. I'm second vice president, I'll be first, and I'll be president, because that's the way it's sort of the system works. I'll be president in 1999 and into the year 2000. Well, actually, be
2000.
I'll take office June of 1999 and finish June of the year 2000 when Melissa graduates. So it's going to be a real interesting sort of milestone for both of us. But then after that, I'll feel like I've sort of can do something else, but I want to stay where I am till she graduates from college. But one of sort of my plan is to sort of be able to travel and visit with other associations and sort of become more visible and develop some constituencies out there.
Are there many Chicanos, other county clerks and district clerks in these meetings?
Mm-hmm. Especially in the Valley and in small communities like in West Texas, we have some county and district clerks that are Latino.
Do you all have a separate caucus?
No, but we stay in contact a lot. I mean, no, we don't have a separate caucus, but I work with a lot of them.
Tell me, you knew Ann Richards before.
Yes.
Even before she was county commissioner. What's your relationship with her? When did you meet her?
I met her. You're going to like this one, this story. In 1968, when I first moved here, and I was working, for the state. There was a guy there who was older, and I was like 21 or 22, who I started dating from the agency, who was very good friends with Dave Richards and Ann, and every weekend we'd go out and join them for partying, right? So this was in 68. So I've known Ann a long, long time. And I was sort of the young, sweet thing around because everybody was in their 30s and having a great time and a ball. And that was like the nucleus of liberals here in Travis County that were doing something. So I was kind of on the periphery. I was kind of, they would discuss all this stuff that was going on, and I was just sort of there, but I wasn't really into it, right? And so we've known each other for a long, long time. That gentleman that I used to date is now deceased, but we became friends way back. So she remembers me. So when she ran for county commissioner, I definitely wanted her. Well, I knew her when she ran, when she worked for Sarah Weddington. And then when she ran for county commissioner, I was supporting her. As a matter of fact, I introduced her to Moya, and I said, and Moya was supporting her opponent because he was an incumbent. And I said, Richard, I know you and Ann will get along. They're great. You know, she's the type of person that you guys would get along great. Sure enough, the next, as soon as Ann got elected, they became best buddies, and they've been friends ever since. But he didn't support her when she ran. And of course, from there, and she served in 82. When I came into the county, it was like the last couple of months that she was leaving to run for county treasurer. So I never really worked with her when she was at the county, because I was just sort of learning the way county worked, and she left to run for office. But I've supported her in every race, and she's been great. She's been great to me. And we have a good relationship.
Did you ever speak with her about her lack of really commitment to Chicanos and even the campaigns? She would, other than the Valley, mm-hmm. she'd go see blacks, but she would not go to Chicano groups in Dallas or El Paso or Houston. Or were you aware of that?
No, well, I wasn't aware of that. I know I worked on the campaign in Seguin. I did some work in Seguin for her, and but I wasn't involved in sort of the inner circle that did all of the all of the scheduling and all that. She did come to the Hispanic Women's Network several conferences, but because we were involved, I guess, and she did come to be with us in Laredo, and she came. I mean, so she, from my perspective, she was involved with some of the things that I was involved with, but I didn't. I wasn't into the scheduling part, but we did get her to come to a couple of our big conferences.
How much damage do you think was done by the fiasco with Lina Guerrero?
For Hispanics as a whole? I think some people still think that it was a bad situation for Lina. And I think that when we'll look at it 20 years from now and say that she was run out of office because, you know, she wasn't truthful on her, that she had a degree or not, that people are going to look to that as very sort of frivolous. I myself would never say that. I mean, I would not say I had a degree, and if I didn't, I mean, that's just me. That's how I am. But it seemed like it was not. If it had been that she got run out because she stole money, or that she did something she wasn't supposed to do. But I think Lena had a good record of service. She did some great things when she was in the legislature, when she was in the Railroad Commission. She was a tireless worker. I mean, I supported her. I didn't agree that, you know, with what had happened, but I think she got a bad rap. I've seen other people lie about that and not get, I guess.
Why do you think Gonzalo didn't fight back when they denied him the right to run for Congress, and we lost not only a seat on the Supreme Court, but also did not gain a Mexican-American congressman? It's time.
I think he felt like the money, he was going to need a lot of money, and it was not going to be there, that it would dry up. And I think, I don't know that he's regretted that decision, but I think a lot of people were really disappointed that he didn't do it, me included. But I don't know what his reasons were, other than I think he felt like maybe they told him, you know, if you do it, we won't support you. I don't know. I mean, that's my feeling.
Who is the most effective Mexican-American political leader today at any level?
Who? Well.
Or all levels?
In my estimation, it was Henry.
Which one?
Cisneros. I think because he's high in government, I think Federico might be one. Spokesperson, I don't know that he is. But maybe Raúl Izaguirre, I don't know. I don't have any kind. State? Probably, I mean, from my perspective, Irma Rangel is high up there. She's been able to do. Local, Gonzalo.
It seems that you didn't mention him in the state, but you mentioned Irma, but local you would mention Gonzalo. Is he pretty much the Chicano leader, the Mexican leader? And controls the groups and things?
Yeah.
Okay. What's the most effective Mexican-American organization today?
Well, I don't think it's LULAC anymore. I think... maybe the United Farm Workers.
What's the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans today?
The most pressing issue. I think immigration has to be up there. I don't know that it's the most pressing one, but I think it's definitely an issue that we need to. And I don't think we have sort of a plan for it. I mean, I don't think none of us have.
Well, then will be a second one if you have problems putting that one as the most pressing.
Well, I think education has always been a problem. I don't think we've ever really gotten a handle on why it is the way it is and why our kids are still dropping out of school and why we can sort of keep them in this system. If it's not the system, then why have we not designed a system where we're able to.
Black-brown relations, what are the underpinnings of tension?
Underpinnings? I think they don't...
Tension.
Yeah, I think that there are some things that blacks don't support that are Hispanic issues, like bilingual education. And I think Latinos see... that everybody else sees it just as a black and white issue. I mean, look at advertisers, look at everybody. I mean, you don't see that Latinos are not part of what's going on in this country, and we are. I mean, we're involved in every day, just like everybody else. And I think the media has a lot to do with how Latinos are seen or viewed, because it never becomes a national... there's never a national platform for the three major ethnic groups to be seen together or discuss things. Or every once in a while you see maybe one or two Latinos, and that's it. Or anyway, but then you get something like the Cisneros case, and of course it's viewed as... And every time you see something in the newspaper, it's about all these elected officials in the valley that got indicted for something rather. I mean, it's never... Very few times is it very positive. Is it positive? But I think the media has a lot to... And I think we don't have enough Latinos in the media, that's why.
Chicano-Mexicano relations. What ought to be our contact with Mexicans, and what should Mexicans be doing with Chicanos?
I think there should be a lot more contact. I think one way to bring people together, if it's not politics, then it's the arts. And Mexico has this an incredible, rich art I mean, it's so much to offer us that I don't think we're fully taking advantage of that. And I think that art has a way of bringing people together. And that's why I'm involved in the arts, because I think in order we need to promote our own artists, but it also has a way of bringing communities together, bridging communities.
What Mexican civil rights groups do you belong to?
Civil rights groups? Have I belonged to, or do I belong to?
No.
Let's see. I guess I support the United Farm Workers, always have, ever since I was. I mean, it's not a civil rights group, but...
You send them money, or what?
Yeah, I send them money.
You're not a farm worker, obviously.
No, I'm not, and I never was, but I have a lot of... I mean, I support them ever since I was a student, and I ran the United Farm Worker Organization, and we did the lettuce boycott and all that. But I continue to support them. I believe in what they're doing. I think that they need all the support they can get. I mean, even now, I still... I mean, Cezar is probably one of my heroes.
I see
heroes.
Some things on the wall, and we could film that if it's important to you. No memberships. Do you belong to LULAC, GF Forum, NALEO,
I'm a member
MALDEF,
I'm a member of
National Council?
Okay, I'm a member of NALEO. As a matter of fact, we just formed the Latina Foundation, and that Lena and Nora are both involved in, and we're having a training session for Latinas on campaign techniques at the NALEO conference in Houston. So I'm involved with NALEO. I'm also involved with, I don't know that they're civil rights organizations. I've been on the board of MALDEF a long time ago. But I belong to women's organizations, and I do some work with Hispanic Women's Network, with MAPO, Women's Political Caucus, mainly women's organizations.
Okay.
And I'm trying to think, I'm sure there's a group here, but I guess I haven't paid dues or something to MALDEF in a long time, although I believe in what they're doing. I support the Southwest voters. I mean, in terms of what they do. I'm trying to look. I saw a list of some of the activities, and I'm trying to think what I did to them. You want to ask me something else?
What's the essence of your leadership? How do you perceive yourself?
I think I relate well to people. I'm down to earth. I hope I'm never pretentious. I think I bring with me the experiences that I had when I was growing up. It makes me sort of be empathetic to people that have been, that are in situations that, where people are from low income, I mean, lower income status. I can relate to some of the problems that people have. Hopefully I'm able to do some things that will benefit the community, but I hope that I'm never pretentious. I mean, I think that that's
big to know. I'm going to ask you for two anecdotes.
Okay.
Give me one where some gringos got the best of you. And give me one where you've gotten the best of gringos.
So I don't think in those terms, but I'm sure that, I mean, I have to think about...
Well, when the system has manipulated their powers to your detriment, and now that you are part of the system and been involved in a lot of experiences, and occasionally you prevail, you win.
Mm-hmm.
If it comes to mind, I mean, if it doesn't, we can move on to the last part. The last part is simply, if you want to make a statement, is there an area that we haven't covered? I know we were rushed, we pushed. Is there something you want to say? You want to talk? Something you want to talk about that I didn't ask you about? Something that's meaningful, some great accomplishment, some great disappointment? Any closing remark?
Yeah, I think there is something that I'm involved with right now that I think is real important. When... I guess when you get to a certain point, and then you think, are you really making a contribution other than, you know, being an elected official? And how are you helping your community? Because I think that that's something we all want to do. And in order to also get involved in the community, I've, you know, picked and choose what things I want to do. Well, I'm president of the Austin History Center, and it's taken a little while for me to get there because I've been involved with it. And the Austin History Center preserves the history of Austin. Well, when my daughter was with the National Hispanic Institute and we were trying to do some work with, I got involved with the parents, we wanted to do a display of a Hispanic because we have like a statewide group. And I got the parents involved and we were going to do this display of Dr. Americo Paredes. So one of the parents went to the library to look about, to find out a little bit more about him. There was nothing at the library in Austin about Dr. Americo Paredes. Well, everything's at UT, so people, well, parents couldn't get to UT to go do some work out there. So I was at one of the Americo Paredes lecture series. We were looking, I was standing there, and David Montejano was looking at some pictures, and they had been provided by the Austin History Center. And I said, well, look, we have I'm on the Austin History Center, and what I'd like, I mean, we have no work that, I mean, we had some Latinos, oral histories on Latinos, but we didn't have anything to be proud of. I mean, we had the politicians, people that, you know, that, but what triggered it is that this parent who was, you know, a regular parent that had a student that was involved in this program wanted to find out more about him, so she went. She said, well, I'll go to the library, I'll find something about him. Well, it was nothing. I mean, she didn't. So she doubted whether this man was really as famous as, or as important as we thought he was. And so we, out of that conversation that David and I had, I said, I'd like to have some oral histories done of Mexican Americans in this community. And I was on the oral history committee at the time, and the chairperson was also very, who was Anglo and very West Austin. We wanted to hear about Mexican-American businesses, people that have been in Austin for, well, this is our third year that we have collaborated with the Mexican-American Study Center, and David started with his class, and he provided all of the interviewers. I drafted a list of interviewees. We paired them together. The first year, we had a wonderful experience where the students really, really got into interviewing older people here in Austin. This is our third, we're getting into our third year. We just had our meeting the other day. But I think that illustrates why it's important to be in this mainstream organization, involved in mainstream organizations, because otherwise people don't think about those things. They don't think that there's no Mexican Americans. Oh, well, that's the way it's supposed to be. And here we are. I think we've interviewed maybe up to probably 30 or 40.
On videotape?
No, it's on cassette. Yeah, no, it's not on
video.
The
videotape.
Yeah, well, that's an idea. We hadn't thought about that.
You need to see the people. You know.
Yeah.
Words, for example, like the pauses that you had today don't appear on a transcript.
Yeah.
People don't know that you hesitated, for example, to answer
leadership.
But they will when they see the video.
Yeah.
And that's a very telling remark. It's just visual.
Yeah.
Really recommend.
Well, I'm sure there are some instances that I'll have to think about it. I mean, I have to think about what you asked me. I wasn't...
No, I'm talking about using video.
Oh, yeah.
I was just giving an observation of why you need to capture certain things. Well, anything on the anecdotes or anything else on the, on the Austin History Center?
Let's see.
If they don't come to mind, it's no problem.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of...
Anything else you want to say?
I guess what I'd like to say is that I hope that Mexican-American, Hispanic, Latino women need to be involved in the political... in electoral politics, and we need more elected officials that are Latinas and Latinos. And I think that day is going to come. And I think, like I said, I think we're going to have an opportunity to
to pick and choose some of the offices that we, so we need to be ready. So we're not ready, and we need to be prepared, and I think it takes, part of being a leader is to prepare yourself.
Well, I want to thank you for the time that you spent with me, and
sure.
This has been a good interview. I'm now just shooting some of the things in your kitchen, which is where we've done the interview. That light kind of messes that up, but these are Amado Peña paintings, and they've got more across the room and in the other room. So, again, thank you very much, Amalia.
Nos vemos.
Good to see you again.
Andale. Gracias.